go and think about anybody on your own.
Right. So, you know, and if I ever left, you know, I felt that, you know, I get strength from my ancestors. They let me out on a pass recently during Thanksgiving. And before I went in the house, I went to the graveyard to, you know, have communion there with my father and grandfather. Just kind of, you know, went and saw the open prayer there. I get a tremendous amount of strength, even though I know that they're dead. I think their spirit is still much alive in me, and that makes me strong. I always imagine, well, what would my father do? What would my grandfather? What would John Chase have done in this sequence? And I get strength from that.
You don't have the concept of family, did you know that?
Well, this has been passed on. I didn't know, you know, I know that a lot has been passed on in my family that is traditional African.
Someday we'll ever need to talk about Zamani and the other aspects of the Africans continuing on both sides of the line.
I know for once in my family, our concept of time is very similar to the African concept of time. We look backwards. And that is another reason. I don't sit in prison and worry about what's going to happen. When they gave me the 34-year sentence, that didn't come down on me in terms of, well, now I'm going to be a gray-haired old man when I get out. I was concerned with the present and looking back and towards what this is a struggle against, you know, a generation of black people. And I get a tremendous amount of strength that way by not looking into the future with a lot of fear. Now, that may seem like a contradiction because I am a Christian minister and Christianity has an eschatological hope toward the future. But I don't get hung up into that because I have a basic understanding of, through the black experience that you can either live in hell or heaven now. You know, and that's what I'm concerned about, and that's what, you know, has been my whole experience. So this experience has been a religious experience. That's why I wrote those songs. Some of those songs are sort of existential descriptions of what I was going through in different circumstances while in prison. And each of them show while it was somehow a lot of hardship, there was a lot of strength that still came out of even the hardship. Yeah. I just refuse to be defeated by white racism or by repression. If I have any look in the future, is in this, in terms of what my children will look in terms of how their father was and what their children will look. That's my only conception of the future, is in terms of how the next shape of generation will deal with what has to be dealt with in this world. You know, my mother and father worked too hard for me to leave this state, to leave the land that they tried to hold on to for generations. You know, and so there's a lot more in stake than just the individual Ben Chavis, you know.
What are you going to do when you are free?
When I'm free, I'm going to go home and stay a while with my family. As you know, I'm the only Chavis male left in my family. Right. And, my son, at least I have a son, Ben the Third. And so I have to have a tremendous amount of responsibility on me, which I readily accept.
One more.
Right. My father, the rest of my sisters. And they're all from married and everything, have their own family. So I have the family's heritage to deal with, which I welcome. I'm not trying to relinquish that responsibility. I don't dread it. I welcome that, you know, in terms of getting that together. Taking care of my family business. And then in terms of a lifestyle, life experience, I continue to work in civil rights, human rights movement. I'm going to try to do what I can, my part, to help pull together a more unified struggle. Things are so splendid right now. You know, I know Jesse Jackson, Brandon Jordan, Ben Hooks and all of them. But what I'm going to try to do is forward some unity in the movement. Because I perceive that we are regressively getting worse and worse in terms of black people's lifestyle in this country. And it doesn't really have to do with inflation either. It has to do with our disunity. It has to do with our losing our concept of brotherhood and sisterhood. You know, I think that, and then I think that the black church has a major role to play. And I plan to work through the civil rights movement, through the black church. I probably will continue to work with the Dr. Charles Cobb and the United Church of Christ Commission for Racial Justice. Mm-hmm. And I intend to go back at some point, probably to the front line of the struggle. You know, I know there's going to have to be some more marches, some more demonstrations. So, you know, and another thing, I have to show in my own life that I have not let the state broker me either. I think that's very important. Because y'all young people are looking at this case to see that they're not going to get involved in civil rights if they feel that, well, it's not worth it. Look what can happen to you. You can get sent off to prison and get all broken to pieces, and it's really not worth it. I'm not going to let our struggle go down in vain. That's what I'm trying to say. It's too much at stake.
Do you have any opinions about the present administration and its attitudes towards the women's intent?
Right. I think that the Carter administration has tried to ignore the women's intent, but it's a case that cannot be ignored. On the one hand, you have a president that has made quote-unquote human rights the pillow of his policy, domestic and foreign. And yet, when there's an opportunity to exercise or to concretely exhibit his concern for human rights within a U.S. case, United States case, the president tries to sidestep it. Being a Southerner, I think this is traditional. Most Southerners... I think Jimmy Carter is acting in the Southern tradition, where he says one thing and does another. Mm-hmm. I think that the reason recently why the United States Justice Department has finally intervened in the case, or should have intervened a long time ago, the reason why they finally intervened is because of the people pressure, public pressure, because of the international pressure, because people are now beginning to look back at the United States and point to the contradictions here. Mm-hmm. And that is why finally the Carter administration is doing minimally something by intervening in a case in terms of a writ of habeas, a Milkos Kirui friend of the court brief to our Milkos Kirui that's present in the federal court. However, you know, what the federal government should have done, what the Carter administration should have done, is come down here and indict those people, Jay Stroud, the prosecutor, and the folks that violated our civil rights. Those folks have gotten away with a very vicious, hideous crime, putting 10 innocent people in prison and labeling them as criminals for the rest of their life.
Is this case going to be an issue in the next presidential election?
I'm sure it will be. I think that the Wilmington 10 case, as far as its social impact upon American society, is very similar to the Scottsboro Boy case. This case will go down in history as being a case not only of racial injustice, but a case of governmental intransigence or governmental collusion with Southern races under the guise of the administration of criminal justice. The case of the Wilmington 10 will be talked about for generations. At least I know in the Chavis family it's going to be carried on into the future. Well, and let me say that on December the 11th of this year, we presented at the United Nations for the first time a documented brief documenting human rights violations in the United States. This is the first time it's ever happened. We have formally brought the United States of America up for charges for human rights violations. On this, the United Nations has a committee on human rights, and this document was given to Kurt Waldheim, the Secretary General of the United Nations, on December 11th. This comes at the 30th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was adopted in 1948, the year I was born. And I might add that in the last 30 years, the United States has not ratified the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, when other countries in the world have. And again, this shows a contradiction. This country is really not serious about human rights.
Now that the federal government has intervened somewhat sort of left-handedly. Mm-hmm. What do you expect to come of that?
Well, based on my past experience, and again, I'm looking to the past because that's where I make decisions based on what has already happened, not on any kind of ethical judgments or what might happen in the future. Based on past experience, that the federal government's intervention will only mean that the case will get greater exposure in terms of being a case of gross racial injustice in America. I do not think that, of course, the federal government has the capacity and the power to come right down and free us immediately, but they won't do that. What they have done is sort of a cosmetic wonder dressing. That they're still pretending like they're for human rights, pretending like they're for racial justice, when in fact they have allowed this case to go on now for seven long years.
Alrighty. Well, now, is there anything else you want to add, just talking generally, points that you think would be significant in trying to give an overview of your history, your life, your work, your interests, your future, your intentions, your philosophy?
Well, yeah, I think that my involvement in the Wilmington 10 and in many other cases, again, see, I've been arrested a number of times. I think that the Wilmington 10 case is just a culmination of a long series of harassments, assassination attempts, by those forces in our society who do not want social change. And I think this is, you know, I have sort of inherited the struggle spiritually and physically, not only from the generation that I grew up, but I'm looking ancestral and now in terms of the struggle of my relatives, John Chambers. And he tried to bring about social change in America through education, on up through the various generations where black people, it can be documented that we have tried to change America, to make America stand up to its creed. And in those instances where brothers and sisters have tried to change America, to make it stand up to its creed, the system has recalled, the system has repressed those efforts. And so we've become victimized further by a system that we're trying to change. We've become the victims. But so I, you know, in an overview, I think that you know, part of what I'm doing in my life is I see as my historic responsibility, my ancestral responsibility.
You see it as a part of your destiny.
Destiny, right.
Something you were born to do.
Yes.
Something that you must do.
Right, just an unfolding destiny. I think, you know, the longer I live my life, the more that becomes more and more clear to me. That our whole life is unfolding a destiny that was started on the shores of Africa.
Okay. Tell us just a little bit about what your life in prison has been like since you have been on release time.
All right. I'm allowed, for the last 3 months I have been, or 4 months, I have been attending Duke Divinity School at Duke University in Durham. I leave the prison at 7:30 in the morning. Prison guards bring me to Duke University campus and they pick me up at 5 o'clock. I live in a warehouse-type prison with 80 prisoners. I sleep in, on the top of a bunk bed. The situation at the Orange County prison in Hillsborough, North Carolina is one of very, it's a dehumanizing environment like all prisons in America are. It's filthy. There is harassment by prison guards or prisoners. What I have tried to do since I've been in prison, since I've been out on release, I'm almost living two lives. I am certainly not free when I'm out here on Duke's campus, because I, several occasions, prison guards have been out here on the campus, look in the classrooms to see if I'm in the classroom. They have harassed me several times since I've been out here on campus. They continue to let me know very concretely that I am a prisoner of the state, even though I'm studying part-time at Duke University. As I've said before, I take education very seriously because I think I have to continue to try to prepare myself educationally, so I'm grateful for the opportunity to study here. And even before coming to Duke Divinity School, I tried to study all I could and read. That's how I spend most of my time in prison, is reading and writing, trying to answer the correspondence. I get about 100 letters a week from around the country, around the world, supporters, and I try to answer all that mail, and I try to do some writing, try to keep a diary of my activities.
Anything else you want to say about the dumpster?
I think that takes care of it. Yeah, I think that's
okay. Who are the great men of this century, for the time?
Of this century?
Whose lives have made a difference, or will make a difference?
W.B. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr. Then historically, I would say Frederick Douglass, Nat Turner, and as far as my family is concerned, I would say John Chavis. As far as my own contemporary work, there is one man that has had a tremendous amount of impact on my life, and that would be Dr. Charles E. As far as contemporary work, and my work that has, why I continue to work with the Commission for Racial Justice, one man has had a strong impact on my life, and that would be Dr. Charles E. Cobb, who is the Executive Director of the United Church of Christ Commission for Racial Justice. Then, of course, Angela Davis had a tremendous impact on my life. Here in Raleigh, Reverend Leon White, who I work, my co-worker, associate. Eric Joyner and Bill Lamb.
Yeah.
I'll just name some people who put out. But if I had to say the single most important impact on my life has been the work of Martin Luther King Jr.
Okay.
If I had an idol or somebody I was trying to devote my life toward, it would be Martin Luther King Jr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Do you think the King philosophy continues to shape or to impact the society in any significant way?
In 1978, no. Because the King philosophy requires activity, activism. And the sad commentary of our situation in 1978 is that 10 years after his death, no one is really putting King's theory of nonviolence, civil disobedience, into action. I think up to the point of his death, King's philosophy, King's theology, ideology was very effective. But after his death, no one took up the banner. And that is why we're in I believe that is one reason why Black America is in the state it's in today. We've stopped struggling the way we should be struggling. Uh-huh. When I get out of prison, I will attempt to implore and utilize some of Dr. King's philosophical tactics and methods towards struggle, namely nonviolent civil disobedience.
You know, I was born the month and year that Mohammed Gandhi was killed. He was assassinated in January of 1948.
Might be a continuation of that,
though. Yeah, I'll just threw that in. It's interesting.
Thank you, baby. Well, any other comments you want to make?
No, not that I can think of. I guess once we begin to put the overview together, I may could see something where we can add in.
Yeah.
Right. But I think we got a good overview. We got a whole tape here on both sides, and this is another side on here. I've labeled.
Oh, you're a little solid. Okay.